You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Sarah Collins.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, book one by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, book two in the series. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat in the chair, hand on keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. Before we get into our show with Lauren Meckling, we have an audio excerpted courtesy Penguin Random House audio from How Could She by Lauren Meckling, narrated by Brittany Presley. Thanks for listening. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Sarah Collins on the show with me today. She has a mind-blowing new book. It's called The Confessions of Franny Langton, and this book is quite unlike anything I've read in a long time. I'm really looking forward to talking with you about it today. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Hank, and thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I think I have always wanted to be a writer, and so I don't have a clear first memory. It just seems like something that has always been there. But I suppose I first formed the intention when I was about 10 or 11 years old. And by forming the intention, I mean set about starting to try to write. So I would do these, what I called my little homemade stories, which were essentially very, very bad short novels about a girl having adventures at boarding school, which I would handwrite and then try to get my brothers to read, and they were never interested.
I love the idea of forming an intention. Because we, you know, as artists, as writers, we talk a lot about sort of ethereal things and motives and giftings and things like that. And I absolutely believe that there's a certain population of people that just have a storytelling, I don't know, gene, gift, however you want to, you know, look at that. But I think some people are more inclined to tell stories. But then there are the people that form intentions, like you said, and set out to be good at the craft. And I absolutely love that idea.
Yes, I think it's so true that some of us feel like we were born with it, you know, that it isn't something that gets switched on at any point. It's something that is always there. But I'm giving a speech tomorrow to a school about how you go about achieving this thing, which seems so impossible, you know, having a book published. And one of the things that I want to say to them is that a plan is more useful than a dream. So, you know, that ties in with forming an intention. So you want to write a novel, but so what, really? No one else but you will care unless you start taking concrete steps to figure out how you do it and to get it done.
Well, as a young person, did you have an adult or a person of influence who recognized this desire that you had and recognized these intentions that you were forming, maybe a parent, maybe a teacher, someone who had influence over your life?
I think there were two. I think it was bookended by my mom, who says that I started to read very early. And I hear this from a lot of writers, actually, that one of their parents says to them, oh, you were a real prodigy when it comes to reading. But my mom says, oh, you know, you started reading when you were three. And by the time you were four, I would have you sitting at the kitchen table and you'd read the newspapers to me. And I think and reading was our thing. You know, she read to me, I read to her, and we've been doing it since I was four. And I think that's where the early love came from. It's certainly the first time I was exposed to the magic and the feeling of connection, not just between me and my mom, but between me and the writers, you know, that connection between reader and writer, which I loved. And I've often said that reading long enough and lovingly enough flips a switch and makes you want to write. And that happened for me. And then the first person who I remember taking my writing seriously and telling me it was good was an English teacher. And again, you hear this so often, don't you? But the English teacher who certainly changed my writing life is one of the people I named in the acknowledgements to the novel. And that was Mrs. Mountcastle. When I was about 13 to 15 or 16, she taught me English. And she encouraged me. She said, you know, you're good at this, and I hope you keep doing it. And luckily, I was able to get in touch with Mrs. Mountcastle after the book was published and send her a copy of the book. And that is one of my most treasured memories of the whole publication process.
You know, we talk a lot about the dark, lonely days that a lot of writers go through when it's just you and the manuscript, and you know, those doubts come in, and You know, am I ever going to finish this? Will anyone like it? You know, is it going to connect with anyone on a heart level? You know, is am I just wasting my time? And so often those little pieces of encouragement just stick in your brain and come back time after time and keep us going.
It's true. And despair was one of my biggest challenges through the writing process. I really did have many of those dark days. And in fact, I gave up halfway through. And I remember the feeling of immense relief when I gave up, you know, well, you don't have to do this anymore. You actually can give yourself permission to quit. But I also remember very distinctly that that lasted for just about one night. And by the time, you know, that the night was over around five the next morning, as usual, as had always been the case, I was woken up with this urge to get right back to work. And I think one of the things that, you know, I tell it, it was like I would often be woken up by lines that I knew Franny wanted to say. And then there would be this kind of compulsion to get back to the desk and get them down before I lost them. And that happened again. And I think part of that came from knowing that there was that there had been other people who had shown that confidence in me before. And even when I didn't feel it, perhaps they weren't mistaken and I could keep going.
Despair lasts for a night, but in the morning. That should be a proverb or something. Oh, man. You, Sarah, you have a lovely accent. Where do you hail from?
It's a real mix, and people are always flummoxed by my accent. So I was born in Jamaica, which is where the novel is partly set. When I was very young, we moved from Jamaica to the Cayman Islands. I was only 4 years old, and we left because of the political violence that erupted in the aftermath of the 1976 elections in Jamaica. But when I was 11, I left Grand Cayman to come to boarding school in England and then bar school. I qualified as a barrister here before going back home to work as a lawyer for a while. And so I think the accent is a mix of all three places, but also my perspective on life is a mix of all three places. And I like to say the impetus for writing the book came from that feeling of having moved around so much but never belonging anywhere, and reading and writing is a good way to anchor yourself in the world somehow, I think. And also, of course, writing about Jamaica and England, I think, were my ways of bringing in two of the places I've lived in and loved into my work.
Well, that's fascinating that you lived in those places and that you moved with intention with your family, because the book, you know, has these different lights and shades depending on you know, where we're traveling with Franny and how the story is following. And you know, people talk about place becoming almost a character in the book, and that is definitely true. There's a different feeling to the story when we're in Jamaica and when we're in England. Was that a conscious thing for you, that when you are shifting places, that you are revisiting these places of your youth?
What was conscious, I think, was what each place had to say about Franny or the other characters interacting with her in the places and their states of mind and their motivations. So one of the things that I learned during the course of writing this novel is that setting will only come alive if it's always sparking off what the characters are doing or feeling there.
That's a great point.
The distinctions, and I can see it now that I read, you know, if I sort of look at the novel again, that there is this distinction between Jamaica and London in mood and in energy. But I think that comes from the characters, as does everything in a successful novel, really. And so it wasn't that I was sort of deliberately setting them up to be different, but because I was channeling them through the work I was doing on characterization, that somehow came about.
Boarding school for, I would say, most people in the United States is a foreign concept. We see people in movies and we read in books and we can't quite wrap our head around boarding school, and it It seems to be much more common in England and various British territories, or you know, however you look at that. But how do you feel like that experience shaped you as a writer? And maybe how do you feel like it shaped how you see the world?
Yes, I have a lot of American friends who tell me boarding school is almost a punishment there, that if you get sent away, then yes. It really is sent away. Like, why didn't your family want you? Whereas for me, it was a huge privilege. It was the thing that my parents sort of saved up and scraped pennies to make sure they could afford. And I hated it at the time. I was homesick. I was extremely cold and not used to being cold. And, you know, I was far away from home and everything that was familiar. But now I realize it was one of the great advantages of my life, not only because I got a great education and probably better than I could have in the small island that my family lived in back in the 1980s, but also because there is a sense of loneliness that comes from being at boarding school. Even though I had great friends, there is a sense of having very early on to navigate the world on your own in some ways. And I think that's really useful for a writer. I think it's really useful for writers sometimes to feel like they're standing outside of things and observing. And that is how I felt, you know, moving to a new place as a very young person and working out how to fit in and how to get along. And I don't think I've ever quite lost that. So that kind of outsider status and trying to figure out how things work. But I think also that comes from having been an immigrant, and maybe they're the same experience, I don't know. You know, because I also was an immigrant, I suppose, a twofold immigrant, moving right. from Jamaica and then to England. And again, it's that outsider status and that slight loneliness and perhaps not quite fitting in that I think gets you to look at things differently and to try to figure out why people do what they do.
I think that's a fantastic point. I agree. And as every writer who's listening to this looks back on their life, I think we can all put our finger on at least some experience where we felt like the outsider and we felt like, the one that didn't quite fit in or who was out of his or her element. But I think that builds empathy.
I think that's right. And I think also the characters that leap off the page or that leapt off the page for me as a young reader were also outsiders. I'm thinking of Jane Eyre and Joan March in particular, you know, the characters I consider to be formative. They had that quality of standing on the edge of things and observing and being slightly different. I mean, I think it's reinforced by reading and it certainly builds a writer's personality.
Sure. What drew you to the law and wanting to be a lawyer? That's an interesting career move for someone who has built intentions around writing.
I had formed intentions around writing, but I should say I never really took them seriously because no one else took them seriously for a very long time. You know, writing a novel isn't something that you can really sort of declare that you're going to do at the age of 11 or 12 and have anyone think that seems like a sensible idea. So law for me was in many ways a poor substitute for that. It was a way of trying to make a living by doing something as close to storytelling as I could get, I think. My dad had been a criminal barrister and I grew up with, watching him prepare for trials and realizing early on that lawyers often engaged in the same kind of business that novelists are. Making a narrative, using words. In fact, there's an episode in the novel where Franny is watching the lawyers during her trial and saying exactly that, you know, words are the tools of their trade and how lucky they are to be able to use them. And I think I was trying to content myself with that. Well, if I can't be a novelist, I'll be the next best thing. But I was always a miserable lawyer because I really wanted to be a novelist. And a series of events, including giving up work to look after our children when they were very young, kind of finally gave me permission. So, you know, I'd always had the urge and I'd had the intention, but what I was missing was the permission. And I thought I came to at the age where I realized if I didn't try to do it, I probably was never going to try. And I just allowed myself to try.
Well, the new book, The Confessions of Franny Langton, after talking with you and hearing the story behind you, this book really comes alive in a different way for me. Tell people a little bit where this book came from. Who is Franny Langton, and what is so exciting and scary about her story?
So just by way of brief summary, Franny is a young Jamaican woman who is brought to London in the early 19th century. And she is given as a gift by her owner to George Benham, who's a famous natural philosopher. And she becomes a maid in his Mayfair mansion, but very, very quickly develops an overwhelming attraction for her new mistress, who is a perpetually dissatisfied and enigmatic French woman named Marguerite Benham. And the two embark on a twisted love affair, which ends tragically because months later, both George Benham and Marguerite Benham are found murdered. And Franny's found lying next to her mistress, her dead mistress, with blood on her hands. And so we start, the novel opens with Franny being brought into the Old Bailey, which is the main courtroom for criminal trials in London. And she's on trial for these double murders. Her lawyer urges her to give him something that he can save her neck with. And she's adamant that she couldn't have murdered her mistress because she's the only person she's ever loved. But at his urging, she starts writing an account of her life. And what she's trying to do is convince the reader, but it becomes clear to us that she may also be trying to convince herself that she couldn't have done these things that she's accused of.
Oh, man, such a so many layers to the story. From some of the references that you've mentioned along the way, is this time period a period that you are especially fond of?
Yes. Franny came directly from my teenage obsession with Gothic romances and sort of early 19th century literature. So she's a direct tribute to Jane Eyre, who is one of my favorite protagonists in all of literature, and really one of the first protagonists that I think kind of started me on the course of deciding who I wanted to be as a woman, but also to the classic Gothic romances like Wuthering Heights. And what I really wanted to do with this novel was something I had not seen after a very long and extensive reading life, which was to put a Black woman center stage in a Gothic romance. And in particular, in this time period where it was a limbo period between abolition of the slave trade, but the emancipation of slavery. So people were in this really nebulous category, the people who had been left in the West Indies and almost forgotten about, who were still enduring these terrible conditions as slaves, while people in England were congratulating themselves on having abolished the trade itself. And I thought that was really rich territory for a Gothic romance, which would explore kind of scientific work into the link between race and intelligence, which had been used to bolster the institution of slavery and justify it for so long, but also the hypocrisy of English society, which had been built on the profits from this institution, while at the same time kind of denying that it existed on English shores. And I came across this wonderful story about Francis Barber, who had been a young Jamaican boy brought to England in the middle of the 18th century and given as a gift to Samuel Johnson, who was a famous lexicographer and the dictionary writer and philosopher and essayist. And I was really struck not only by the idea that there was this long tradition of giving people as gifts and, you know, essentially bartering people on English soil, but also by this idea that here you had a young intelligent boy who had been born into slavery but ended up rubbing shoulders with one of the greatest minds of the age. And I just wanted to explore that. And from there, that was really the springboard for Franny's story.
Well, the Confessions of Franny Langton is a provocative book on a lot of levels, and it's one of the most interesting parts of the story to me are the power dynamics that you explore, not only the slave trade, like you talked about, and you know, that we cringe, you know, today thinking about that, and you know, that and watching how characters treat this issue that we find abhorrent. But not only that, but then you know, Franny's relationship with her mistress and how the power dynamic kind of flips on that, and you know, that Franny you know, goes into that relationship with intention, and you know, and a relationship that would have been forbidden on a number of levels. And then we have the power dynamic of the murder trial, and how, you know, Franny is then subjected to, you know, to that whole process. And the way that you explore kind of all the levels of that, the layers of that, is really fascinating to me. One of the, things that I read about the book, The Confessions of Franny Langton, is the story of a woman of her own making in a world that would see her unmade. That's a really great line.
I think the thing that came across most strongly for me the more I worked on developing Franny's character was that sense of willful submission. Very early on, I knew what I wanted to do was write about a woman who was powerless, but also happened to be the most intelligent person in the room, and what that would do to her. And you see that manifested time and time again in her relationships with her masters, who try to sort of make her complicit in their experiments into the links between race and intelligence, in her relationship with her mistress, with whom she falls in love, but about whose love there are questions, you know, whether love can ever exist in an unequal footing. And then in the trial, where again, she's probably more intelligent than the men who are defending her, but she is essentially powerless because of the system, and the system has indicted the wrong person. The men who should be on trial never will be tried. And so I'm glad that that came across, because for me, the thing that really gave her a heartbeat was this idea that, and I don't think it's been explored enough, that one of the great tragedies of slavery, or, you know, of being stripped of power, is how that means you're also stripped of any kind of outlet for the expression of your own intelligence, and how much we must have lost as a result of that, that we will never know. We will never know the contributions that could have been made, or the things that could have been done by the people who had to suffer under those conditions.
Yeah, I don't think that gets explored nearly enough, and that's one thing that I love about this book is Franny is not a powerless woman. She finds herself in situations where her power is being taken advantage of, or, you know, she's at a disadvantage, but she is the smartest, strongest person on just about every page.
Yes, that I really did want that to come across, so I'm glad that it did.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely love the book. I think it's fantastic. What do you hope, Sarah, that at the end, when someone closes that back cover, what do you hope they take away from this story?
That's such a good question. And I'm probably going to give a surprising answer, because I don't know whether this is what readers are taking away, but I'm a huge sucker for a love story, and especially for a tragic love story. I'm a hopeless romantic. You can probably tell, since I've named Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights as two of my biggest influences. And I hope that in spite of the darkness and the difficult things that, you know, that are covered in the novel, that the thing that resonates the most, and it's certainly the last note, I think, in the book, is the love that Franny experienced. Because I think in spite of what happens to her and how difficult it all was, love is the redemptive thing for her, that she's transformed by experiencing it. And it doesn't matter that it's a complicated, twisted, gothic kind of love, that, you know, it's debatable whether it's good for her or not. What matters is that she experiences it, and it's her perception that's important in the end. And so I hope that readers will come away recognizing the importance of having that kind of love and the damage of having it denied to you.
It's a powerful story, that's for sure. And I love what you're doing, Sarah. I don't know how you top a book like this, but are you working on anything new?
I hope I'm going to top it. That's my current aim. I will tell you.
Well, maybe not top it, but have one that would stand alongside it.
It's equally dark and twisted. That's what I can tell you. It's in very early stages, so I don't myself know much more about it other than that. At the moment, it's about a suicide cult in the 1980s in the Caribbean.
So it probably doesn't have as much laudanum as this book has.
No laudanum. One of the rules I set for myself was let's just ease up on the research for the next one. So if you set it in the 1980s, there's more of a chance that you'll remember stuff that you need to put in there rather than having to go and look it up.
True. Sarah, if people are just learning about you and this fantastic new book, is there a place where they can find you online and connect with you?
Yes, I am on Instagram, which is at Sarah Collins Author, and I'm also on Twitter, which is at Mrs. Janie Mack.
Excellent. We'll put links to all of your social media and, of course, to the book and your website into the show notes of this episode. Sarah, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
It was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
The ancient building wore the severe cassock colors of a Puritan minister, a uniform monochrome of slate-gray shingles and soot-gray clapboards, its shadowed upper windows cross-hatched like the facets of a spider's eye. The second story protruded beyond the first and bore the house's only ornament, two gray teardrops of wood, weeping from each corner of the building's stiff upper lip. The place would have looked sinister and foreboding in its shadowed alley if not for the die-cut silhouette of a dancing sheep, jaunty above the door, and the two front bay windows that blazed with colorful, welcoming light. The windows were hung with orbs of colored glass on staggered lengths of ribbon. Each orb glowed with autumnal reds and delicate greens, burgundy tints and pumpkin hues, dappled raspberry and clover lime, streaked with light and weightless as bubbles over a cauldron. The shelves below offered crystal skulls and silver daggers and horny devils, Celtic chalices and woven dream catchers in dreamcoat hues. A primitive broom leaned in a corner, ready for flight, and a rhapsodic nude in bronze clutched her goat-legged lover beneath a jackal bust of Anubis. The interior of the shop was even witchier. Above a crude and sooty fireplace, a stack of brick barely holding the shape of a chimney pushed through the barn-high roof, threading ancient beams that crisscrossed overhead. Brooms and kettles and Christmas lights dangled from these, alongside Halloween costumes and Chinese umbrellas, pointy hats and bundles of herbs. Jason wandered deeper into the shop. His fingers trailed across strange bronze statuary and Aztec masks of turquoise and lapis lazuli. He rolled his eyes at the luck candles and money charms, but goggled indecently at a nude and anatomically correct silver nymph with long golden hair that reminded him of Kate.
"See anything you like?"
Jason jumped, turned, and jumped again. The woman standing before him was the living embodiment of every hippy-dippy counterculture type he'd ever seen. Her hair was green, her face pale and round, her doughy body wrapped in some elaborately woven ethnic garb. Her eyebrows were black and pierced in little rows, and her eyes were heavily circled with midnight blue, as if she'd been sucker-punched by an oil slick. She tapped the glass over the nymph.
"Admiring the goddess, I see."
Oh, she'd practically caught him with porn.
"You want to hold her? She won't break. Here."
The woman flipped open a glass door and handed Jason the naked figure.
"See how heavy she is? You could bang her against the wall all day and barely make a dent."
She waggled her eyebrows, obviously enjoying his discomfort. He checked the price tag.
$700? The goddess is a symbol of love and fertility. Don't be ashamed of desiring her. The woman's long green fingernails plucked a long black cigarette from a long red case, and she lit it. I sense, she blew smoke and studied its whorls. Dissatisfaction in love? Yes, I have just the thing. She pulled Jason into a side room where the smell of her clove smoke gave way to the skunky aromas of potpourri sachets, tea leaves, and hanging clutches of twiggy flowers. She searched, found a little bundle, and pressed it into his hand. This will make you irresistible. Rub it on your nethers twice a day, and love shall surely find you. Jason made a face. The bundle smelled like cow manure. He didn't even want that on his hands.